The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. The Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning, Council. After a recess, we are back in session to hear the third and fourth cases on today's oral argument calendar by Zoom. I will now call the third case. It is A23-1175 in the matter of the welfare of the children of AS and others. Council, I assume that you are familiar with our general procedures. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. You should be able to see a time clock on your screen if you have the proper setting, gallery view, or some other such view. Please leave your camera on at all times throughout the argument. Please mute your microphone when you are not speaking. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your clients, and then you may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Kelly Thiel, and I represent the appellant AS. The issues in this case are whether the district court failed to uphold the Minnesota Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure and state law when they did not inform appellant of her right to counsel and applied a best interest analysis of a transfer of custody to a specific relative to a different relative. I would like to discuss two main points with the court today. First, that appellant was led to believe she no longer had an attorney and that she no longer had a right to an attorney due to the district court's actions. Second, that a best interest analysis is paramount in all child protection cases and must be supported by detailed findings. Rule 36.01 of the Rules of Juvenile Protection Procedure provide every party the right to be represented by counsel in every juvenile protection matter, including through appeal. And 36.03 specifies the court shall advise a parent of their right to counsel on the record if they are not represented by counsel. Requires counsel to continue.
Counsel, that rule that you just referenced, 36.03, that states that any parent who appears in court and is not represented by counsel shall be advised by the court. And so I guess here, mother didn't appear at that February hearing, that is the hearing of interest in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So how does the rule apply where mother didn't appear? I mean, the statute obviously gives her the right to counsel, but I'm wondering about the application of the rule in this situation.
Yes, Your Honor. Because appellant's attorney was never discharged by the court or by appellant, she was still receiving notice of hearings, motions, all reports filed by the county social worker, the guardian ad litem. None of those things were being sent to appellant directly.
So is there somewhere you can point us to in the record that shows that attorney Edmondson, was that her last name?
Yes.
I believe was not forwarding the information on to appellant.
There's nothing in
I'm sorry, the district court found in its order that, I'm looking at A15, that mother was served with notice of this hearing and mother failed to appear and is in default.
So appellant was not served with every notice. Appellant lost contact with her attorney following that May 11th, 2022 hearing where custody was transferred to DS. Appellant also lost all contact with the county social worker and the guardian ad litem, and was not aware that the case was ongoing.
And you
And
feel are those the statements you just made about her losing contact, is that in the record?
it's hard to prove that something doesn't exist, because obviously there's no written document showing that the county stopped contacting appellant or that the guardian ad litem stopped contacting the appellant.
Thank you.
Does the record show, or I believe the record shows that mother was served by mail with notice of that February hearing, but is there any indication in the record that it was returned as undeliverable? Because I think in your brief, you assert that she didn't receive notice of that hearing, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
There was nothing in the record to show it was returned as undeliverable. Things get lost in the mail. This was not sent by certified mail or anything like that. Even so, when appellant did finally make an appearance in the permanency case, the rule doesn't specify that if a party doesn't show up at the very first hearing in a case, that they don't get to be told about their right to representation. So when appellant did finally appear, the court is required to tell her that she has a right to an attorney. Instead, the district court and respondent spoke on the record about how they thought that appellant's attorney had been discharged after they were past permanency, even though there was no final permanency order at that point.
And that was in January of 2023, just before the February 2023 hearing, is that right?
Yes.
So at so when the court had the hearing in February, court was under the impression that mother didn't have an attorney and none was appointed to her at that point.
Correct. And they did not advise the parent of her right to an attorney.
Ms. Thiel, I have a question about sort of how you're describing the error that you're asking us to find and reverse on. In your brief, you're looking at page 6 of your brief, your main heading says, Mother's counsel was improperly discharged prior to a finalized order, dot, dot, dot. And then I think when you opened your argument, you said the district court erred by not advising her of her right to counsel. It seems sort of two different actions at two different times. I would acknowledge we have sort of an unusual situation, but I'm just kind of trying to focus on, when I'm thinking about the case, I'm trying to focus on, at what point in time did the district court commit an error? Or was the district court blameless because of some third party's action or inaction? I don't know. I'm asking a little bit of a big picture question, but I think your answer to that could help me and could help us analyze the case.
Yes, absolutely. And it is a complicated question where there are multiple factors at play. The district court made it sound like appellant's attorney had been discharged. They used the word discharge on the record in front of appellant. But they also did not inform appellant of their right to have an attorney in the permanency part of the child protection proceeding. So it's twofold. The district court was mistaken in thinking that the attorney had been discharged. But they also failed to follow the rules of juvenile protection procedure by informing appellant that she had the right to an attorney. So, despite the fact that there is no record of the attorney being discharged, there is an implication that she was. And that was the only information that appellant had about whether she had an attorney at that point or not.
Is there anything in the record about the attorney who was not actually discharged, was still getting service? I mean, is this a case of inadequate? I mean, she had counsel. Is this more a case of she had inadequate counsel that wasn't effective? Because the lawyer never responded, or I mean, I guess, or is there anything in the record on that part of it?
There's not anything in the record. The only thing that shows the attorney was still being served, obviously, is the register of actions that lists her email address as the contact for appellant and the method of service. We're arguing that this mistake is on the district court, as they are the ones with the responsibility to let parents know that they have the right to counsel.
Counsel, if we were to conclude that the findings on the transfer of custody were inadequate, is it necessary for us, and we were to reverse and remand on that issue, is it necessary for us to reach this first issue? If we
No, I don't think so. If this were to be remanded, it would be important for the district court to inform the parent that she did have a right to counsel, so that she would be able to have representation in order to respond to the county's motion to transfer custody to DL, who she had never been asked about during the relative search by either the social worker or the guardian ad litem. Respondent contends that she had the opportunity to oppose that motion, but again, she was never contacted about that motion, never served with it. And at that point, there was no transfer of custody that was finalized, as the order to transfer custody to DS had been stayed until North Star Kinship could be approved for placement and funding. And that order wasn't finalized before the county then motioned to transfer custody to DL. The other issue with the court's order to transfer custody to DL was they didn't make any detailed findings as to how that transfer would be in the best interests of the children. Instead, they applied the findings and reasons from the old order, which applied to DS. For that, there was a 2-hour evidentiary hearing with testimony from DS, and appellant never opposed that petition because she did not oppose of custody being transferred to DS. She didn't have that opportunity with DL, and no testimony was heard on a transfer of custody to DL, which was improper and not in compliance with the rules of juvenile protection procedure or the spirit of the law, which is to put the best interests of the children as paramount in any juvenile protection case.
Well, counsel, I think you just said there no testimony was heard on the transfer to DL. In the, I think the transcript reflects that there was some brief testimony by the social worker and the guardian ad litem, but that aunt did not testify, and that testimony by the social worker and guardian ad litem had to do with sibling visitation and communication around that. Is that correct?
Yes, I apologize, Your Honor. I meant detailed testimony. Again, this was determined in a 20-minute hearing. The majority of it, as you can see from the transcript, was on administrative issues and not directly speaking to the best interests of the children and how a transfer of custody to DL would serve that.
Is it your view that under the statute, the district court is, well, the statute requires an individualized determination. Does that require specific findings on each of the best interest factors? Or what does that individualized determination language require?
I believe the individualized determination language is to the review of the suitability of that specific relative.
And then, is it your view that the court is required to make specific findings on each of the best interest factors?
Yes, that is referred to throughout the rules of juvenile protection procedure and also the statutes.
I apologize. Your time has expired, but you will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your clients and then begin your argument.
Thank you. Cameron Davis, Faribault County Attorney, on behalf of Respondent Human Services of Faribault Martin County. I'll make my remarks brief and entertain any questions that you'd like to ask if it pleases the court. There has been a lot of discussion in the first 15 minutes of this hearing about the court's failure to advise the appellant of her rights, of the appellant, what the appellant may have wanted to do with respect to the initial petition. The record in this matter is clear. The appellant did nothing in this case for an extended period of time, leaving the courts and the agency and the guardian ad litem to try to figure out what needed to be done with these children right up until she showed up for the first time at the January 4th hearing, leaving everyone scrambling to figure out exactly how to incorporate her much belated wishes about what needed to happen with these children into the actuality that these children had been placed first with DS and then with the alternative custodian once DS's health failed prior to the October post-permanency hearings. There was counsel appointed for the appellant. Appellant chose not to participate at all in the permanency hearings, and we are here because of her brief involvement in one hearing in a span of hearings that lasted well over a year. And so
Also, doesn't the record reflect that Mother, through her counsel, was in agreement with the transfer to grandmother, but then at the January hearing, she expressed concerns about the placement with aunt, and at that point, at the January hearing, the district court stated, I think they discharged their counsel once we got past permanency in this case, and then the county attorney said we did absolutely. So, I mean, you're characterizing it as mother not participating, but it seems like one could also view the record as mother being in agreement with the first placement, but not necessarily with the second, and then the court not the court, thinking that she didn't have counsel and then proceeding at the next hearing without her being appointed counsel or without her being present or so I guess I'd like you to discuss that, but also what are we to make of the district court statement that I think they discharged counsel and then proceeding at the February hearing without her?
I think this statement that I think that counsel was discharged needs to be read in the entire context of that of the court's discussion around counsel. One of the statements made to appellant was, you certainly have the right to obtain your own counsel. Another statement made in that same breath was, that the court would review its ability to appoint counsel and address at the time the motion was heard. The time that the motion was heard, by the way, was scheduled during that hearing. So the notion that
but it was by Zoom, and so you'd need to get, I mean, that yes, there was that discussion, but it was also discussed that it would be by Zoom. So you necessarily would have to receive the notice to be able to participate in the Zoom hearing. Would you agree with that?
I would. I'm also aware that the court uses a standing Zoom hearing, but whether appellant could have been aware of that or not, I don't know. However, there is no indication that she made any efforts to contact court administration or get login information or anything else on the record to indicate that she attempted to participate. So again, she was advised that the issue of appointing counsel would be discussed at that hearing, and she failed to participate in the hearing. Furthermore, when she appeared at the January 4th hearing, she appeared to be objecting more to the fact that she wasn't getting parental visits than she was complaining, than she was objecting to the transferred placement, which had happened more than 3 months prior and before the prior permanency progress review hearing in October of 2022. With respect to the issue of whether or not the court made sufficient, substantiated, and individualized findings, again, the placement had been approved on a temporary basis at the October post permanency review hearing. Prior to that, the DS, the original transferred custodian, had fallen; her health had declined to the point where the substitute custodian had that process had already been initiated. The court had reports from the guardian ad litem and the agency prior to the October post permanency review hearing. It again had reports filed by both of those parties prior to the January post permanency review hearing. At that hearing, in response to the appellant's complaint regarding her contact with the children and the contact between the siblings, the court then directed the agency to perform a specific investigation as to the appropriateness of the placement of the children with the new what ended up being the permanent transfer custodian. That report was filed in advance of the February motion hearing. Although it is not specifically referred to in the transfer order, it is certainly part of the court's record.
The best interest findings in the district court's order are very sparse. What is your best argument that they are sufficient to meet the statutory requirements?
Well, the statute refers to best interest in different ways in different parts of the statute. And I'll refer to, as an example, in 260C.521, that statute talks about what to do had this situation arisen after finalization of the order, instead of in this interim time period between when the order was entered but stayed and completion of the North Star kinship. Under 260C.521, there's a specific discussion that if a transferred custodian is receiving North Star kinship benefits and the custodian becomes incapacitated or dies, the court can modify that order upon motion based on certain requirements, one of them being that the court finds that it's in the children's best interest. In the same statute, subdivision 1A, it talks about when some other party other than a named successor custodian in a North Star kinship assistance benefit agreement can come to the court and bring a motion for modification. And in that part of the statute, the legislature refers specifically to 518, section 518.18 and 518.185, those being the family law statutes that incorporate the what we commonly refer to as the family law best interest factors. So in my reading of those statutes, when I see the legislature nod its head to family law, they are looking to the for the court to make family law related best interest factors. When the court makes, when the legislature leaves those references out, as it does in subdivision B, subparagraph 2 of 560C.521, they don't seem to be looking for the same type of individualized best interest factors that are used in the family law best interest factor 518 language.
But this proceeding wasn't under 0.521, correct?
It was not. That's correct.
So with regard to the statutes that were at issue here, I think they require the best interest consideration of the children's best interests. And the discussion in the order was, you know, one brief paragraph. So how is that sufficient to consider the needs of the best interest set out in 260C.212 subdivision 2B?
I won't disagree that the findings lack specificity, and that they, if the court wants to remand this for further findings, I will say the record exists for the court to make those findings. As indicated, there are numerous post-permanency reports and a specific report on any on an investigation directed by the district court into whether or not this substitute custodian continued to meet the needs of the children. However, those findings are not incorporated in the order, which is certainly a shortcoming of the order.
Okay, thank you.
It appears there are no further questions, Mr. Davis. Do you wish to sum up?
I will. Thank you, Your Honor. In summation, I will remind the court of what I think are the driving factors that the court must consider in determining what to do with this case. Number one, we have an appellant and a parent who, again, has had very little involvement in this court proceeding and with these children since well before the permanency trial in May of 2022. After that trial, the appellant continued to remain absent from the court proceedings as the court struggled with what to do when the custodian fell ill and became incapacitated. The court, upon recommendation of the agency, approved transfer to a substitute custodian in October prior to October. In a transfer that occurred prior to October of 22 and was approved by the court in October of 22. We are here in January of 2024 with children who have been in that home for nearly a year and a half. And so whatever it is that the courts do, we must keep in mind that what we're doing has real impact on children who are have already suffered from numerous traumatic placements as a result of appellant's actions. I'd urge the court to keep that in mind when deciding what needs to be done with respect to the order and whether or not the district court erred in how it handled appointment of counsel for appellant. Thank you. And thank you for your consideration.
I have a related question. If we were to reverse and remand for more detailed findings, the the transfer of permanent legal custody to aunt, what would be the status of the children in the interim? Would they still be temporarily placed with aunt?
I don't believe that placement would be upset, and unless the court struck down that placement, in which case I think you would leave the agency in the position of needing to immediately file a CHIPS case with an emergency protective care order. I would caution the court against that course of action because North Star kinship funding is not available when a child is placed with a child placing agency. So taking an action like that could have the effect of interrupting North Star kinship funding.
Reversing? You mean reversing and remanding for because the findings were inadequate would upset.
If the court reversed and remanded for additional findings without upsetting the current placement of the children, then we can proceed
Ah,
to district
okay.
court to have
All
them
right.
sort this
I
out.
understand.
If
Yeah.
the appellate court was somehow to direct the to strike down the any placement order that places the children in their current setting, that could upset North Star kinship funding.
Sure. And then I've got one other question for you, if that's if I might, even though we're short on time, Judge Johnson, is that okay?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So the district court's order says it's an uncontested order. So if there was counsel, which apparently the counsel was never, mother's counsel was never officially discharged, but it counsel's incompetent and doesn't, I mean, I'm not saying that is what occurred here, but there was no response apparently in this record from counsel. Then how can we say it's uncontested? I mean, isn't that an error when mother had a right to counsel before this permanency disposition was ordered? I mean, I guess it's never mind. It's the same way of arguing the same argument that the other side has put forward.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Davis, for your argument. Ms. Thiel, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Respondent mentioned a driving factor that the parent had little involvement in the proceeding, and the children since well before the permanency trial. Lack of involvement or a delay in involvement does not eliminate any of a parent's right to participate in proceedings and to maintain the right to counsel during a permanency proceeding as well as a CHIPS proceeding. Respondent also said that the court approved transfer to a substitute custodian, but at that point, again, there was no final transfer of custody. That transfer order was stayed until North Star kinship could be approved, and that never happened. So at that point, the children were still in foster care and custody had not been transferred at that point. So they still needed to make those specific findings that a transfer of custody was in the best interests of the children. As far as the impact on the children, obviously that is of utmost importance. And part of the issue that was addressed by the appellant early on in the record was a concern that contact between herself and the children, grandparents and the children, their half siblings, all of that had been cut off since the children were placed with the aunt. If this case were remanded to the district court, that would bring the county's involvement back into this case and would allow focus on the best interest factors of the children to resume. And part of that is keeping contact between people that the children had previous important relationships with. Obviously, that includes the parent, but also siblings and other relatives that have lost contact with the children since this transfer to their aunt. As far as applying the best interest factors of family court instead of juvenile court, the statute still specifies that those best interest factors have to have detailed findings. Because there is no mention of incorporating reports of the social worker or the guardian ad litem into the district court's order to transfer custody to DL, that does not satisfy the statute. It cannot just be implied that an analysis of the best interest factors has taken place and that the interests of the children are best served. Without any other questions, I suppose I can wrap this up, but if there are other questions, I have a little time here.
I think you may sum up.
So in summary, yes, there are a lot of factors that have played into the errors and the shortcomings in this case. Again, lack of involvement or a delay of involvement by a parent does not mean that they lose the ability to participate or the right to an attorney. Appellant did not have an issue with a transfer of custody to the grandmother, but didn't have an opportunity to have any opinion on the transfer to DL. And to say again that the order is uncontested is incorrect, as no opportunity was presented to appellant for that. Thank you for your time today. I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Thiel, and thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its final, its opinion in, I believe, 45 days is the shortened time frame for this type of case.